survive. Ronald Reagan later called The Third World War an unusually important book, and it helped to launch a new literary genre, the techno-thriller, in which military heroism was celebrated, the intricate details of weaponry played a central role in the narrative, and Cold War victories were achieved through the proper application of force. On television, The Waltons, a long-running drama about an ordinary family's struggles during the Great Depression, was facing cancellation. Instead of worrying about how the show's young protagonist, John Boy, would overcome adversity, American viewers were now far more interested in who'd shot J.R., the wealthy lead character of a new series, Dallas. Other family dramas about the rich and dysfunctional soon followed. Dynasty, Falcon Crest, The Colbys. Situation comedies dealing with topical or working class issues, like MASH, Maude, Sanford and Son, All in the Family, were relics of a different era. In Hollywood, the year 1980 marked the end of the highly personal, director-driven filmmaking of the previous decade. Aside from Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull and Robert Redford's Ordinary People, due to open on September 19th, the most notable movies were big-budget comedies, action pictures, and sequels like Smokey and the Bandit 2. The popular music of a historical moment can be more memorable and evocative than its books, politics, or films. A number of songs released in 1980 had the ability to worm their way into your brain and resist all attempts to dislodge them. Do That to Me One More Time by Captain and Tennille. You May Be Right by Billy Joel. Sailing and Ride Like the Wind by Christopher Cross. Disco was finally dead, its fate sealed by the closing of the nightclub Studio 54 and the opening of Can't Stop the Music, a movie starring the Village People. Punk was dead too, and taking its place was the lighter, dance-oriented new wave of Devo, The Police, the B-52s, and Talking Heads. The hard rock of the Rolling Stones had given way to the softer pop sounds of Emotional Rescue. Led Zeppelin broke up, transforming Van Halen into America's favorite heavy metal band. Turning the radio dial on almost every FM station, you could hear rough edges becoming smooth. Outlaw country no longer threatened the Nashville establishment. It had fully entered the mainstream, with Willie Nelson's hit On the Road Again and Waylon Jennings's theme from The Dukes of Hazzard. Bob Dylan now refused to sing any of his old songs. Born Again and On the Road, he played only gospel. John Lennon was in New York City, recording a new album for the first time in years and looking forward in a few weeks to his 40th birthday. "Life begins at 40," Lennon told an interviewer. "It's like, wow, what's going to happen next?" In retrospect, it's easy to say that a particular year marked a turning point in history. And yet sometimes the significance of contemporary events is grasped, even in the moment. The United States of the 1960s and the 1970s, with its liberalism and countercultural turmoil, was about to become something different. The year 1980, the start of a new decade, was when that change became palpable, in ways both trivial and telling. During the first week of September, the anti-war activist and radical Abby Hoffman surrendered to federal authorities after more than 6 years on the run. Before turning himself in, Hoffman sat for a primetime television interview with Barbara Walters. Another radical leader, Jerry Rubin, had recently chosen a different path. In 1967, Hoffman and Rubin had tossed dollar bills over the balcony at the New York Stock Exchange as a protest against the evils of capitalism. In 1980, Rubin took a job as an investment analyst on Wall Street. "Politics and rebellion distinguished the 60s," he explained in the New York Times. "Money and financial interest will capture the passion of the 80s. Rubin had once again spotted a cultural shift and tried to place himself at its cutting edge. At the time, the highest-paid banker in the United States was Roger E. Anderson, the head of Continental Illinois National Bank, who earned about $710,000 a year. The incomes on Wall Street would soon rise. Suits and ties were back in fashion. Mustaches, beards, and bell-bottoms had become uncool, and an ironic guide to the new zeitgeist, the official preppy handbook, was just arriving in stores. During a speech at the Republican convention that summer, Congressman Jack Kemp had noted what others did not yet acknowledge or see. There is a tidal wave coming, a political tidal wave as powerful as the one that hit in 1932, when an era of Republican dominance gave way to the New Deal. No loan zones. At the pre-departure briefing, Childers and his crew learned that major maintenance was scheduled at Launch Complex 374-5 that day. The missile was being taken off alert so that the re-entry vehicle containing its warhead could be replaced. For an instructor crew, major maintenance was a waste of time. Lieutenant Serrano was training to become a deputy missile combat crew commander, and he needed to practice routine tasks in a control center. Captain Mazzaro found a commander who would switch complexes. Instead of 4-5, the instructor crew would go to 4-7, outside Damascus. The change of plans solved the training issue, but delayed the departure of both crews. Entry codes had to be swapped, duty orders rewritten and authenticated. The only important difference between the two launch complexes was their distance from Little Rock Air Force Base. 4-7 was a lot farther away, which meant Childers and his crew probably wouldn't be getting home until noon the next day. Mazzaro, Childers, Holder, Fuller, and Serrano tossed their bags into the back of an Air Force blue Chevy Suburban, climbed into it, and began the hour-long drive to Damascus. Within a mile, the Suburban's alternator light came on. So they had to turn around, go back to the base, find a new vehicle, move their gear, and fill out paperwork before leaving again. The day was not getting off to a smooth start. The 18 Titan II missile complexes in Arkansas were scattered throughout an area extending about 60 miles north of Little Rock Air Force Base and about 30 miles to the east and west. The missiles were dispersed roughly 7 to 10 miles from each other, so that in the event of a surprise attack, one Soviet warhead couldn't destroy more than one Titan II silo. In the American West, ICBMs were usually set amid a vast, empty landscape, far from populated areas. In central Arkansas, the Titan II complexes were buried off backcountry roads,